Hi, welcome to week 7 of our podcast, The Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. I'm John Zogby, and I'm in Miami, and I'm here again with my son and partner, Jeremy.
Yes, this is Jeremy Zogby reporting from Utica, New York, and what a week.
What a week, indeed. So we mixed it up a little bit with a debate. Nevada, and somebody had a really bad night, didn't they, Jer?
It was a train wreck. As I understand it, Mayor Bloomberg may have had the opportunity to experience what it's like to be thrown up against a wall and frisked, only this time by Elizabeth Warren.
Yes. And, it was rather amazing, you know, just I read a number of reviews. Of course, I'm going to review them myself. But one of the things that stood out is the New York Times had about 15 columnists and observers rating each of the performers, the candidates. And number one was for them at an average of 8.4 out of 10 was Elizabeth Warren. Everyone else was between 6 and 7. Mike Bloomberg was given a 2.9, and 4 people actually gave him between 0 and 1. And let's examine why, if I could. I'm just going to start with just a couple of points. I was actually surprised and would have advised Bloomberg to not show up for this debate. Number one, he'd been gaining in the polls, but he's not on the ballot in Nevada anyway. And so for him to have participated was a little bit false. But the other thing is that that center lane we've been talking about still has a number of candidates from Biden and Buttigieg and Klobuchar. And in order for Bloomberg's candidacy to make some sense, there should be a little bit more clarity as to who's going to remain in that center lane for him to take on Super Tuesday. And I just thought that his coming in and coming in Nevada at this point in time was a little bit of bullying, because he came in with a direct message to all the other centrists: get out of the race, make way for Mike, and you know that Mike is going to win the nomination and is the only one who can beat Donald Trump. And apparently that advice not only was not listened to, but he fell flat on his face. And he did very, very poorly. There's no other way to look at it. What do you think?
Well, he was on the defense. Warren came in with some expected attacks, or he should have expected that they were going to ask about the taxes, that they were going to mention the lawsuits, the court-settled lawsuits, and the fact that he's a billionaire. But, you had this sense that Mike Bloomberg was going to bring a lot of energy, and I just didn't see that energy. And that's something that Trump can always boast, is when he's debating his opponents, he commands all of the attention. How is Bloomberg going to fare with Donald Trump if he can't even succeed in knocking out Warren or even Sanders, for that matter?
So let's be fair and make no mistake about it. Mike Bloomberg is an impressive fellow. And when it comes to the ability to govern, or the ability for that matter to get elected, even in circumstances where he may not be expected to win, he does very well. One of the things he is not, though, is a good debater. And you point that out. There is really no reason to expect any energy from Mike Bloomberg. That's just not who he is. He's subdued in terms of his personality. But the difficulty here is that he was almost a perfect foil for Elizabeth Warren, because she was ready, all guns blazing, on several points, guilty as charged. And Mike Bloomberg's defense was either non-existent or just poorly done. At the same time, he was the perfect foil for Bernie Sanders, who is the clear front runner. I mean, Sanders is running against billionaires, and who better to be a foil for Sanders on that stage than a billionaire? And even though Bloomberg's people are saying that he gave a knockout blow to Bernie Sanders by saying, oh, you're a millionaire socialist with three homes. Fact of the matter is, there isn't any evidence thus far that any damage was done to Bernie Sanders' status as front runner. And I do believe that you'll see significant damage done to Mike Bloomberg's candidacy because of this performance. Hard for me to see how he gets back into the game in the South Carolina debate when, again, he's not going to be on the ballot in South Carolina either.
He did a press release, or he did a video post-debate in which he admitted that it wasn't a good performance, in other words, and that the real winner of that debate was Donald Trump. I can see where he would want to do something like that, but was that really the wisest choice? Was that effective? Where does he go from here after admitting that his performance was not good?
You know, as you pointed out in a conversation yesterday, unrehearsed, that you know, that Bloomberg may look like he's trying to bring the entire House, Democratic House, down with his post-debate statements. I agree with that. I think that what he needed to do was show why he is better than the six other candidates who were there on the forum. And obviously he did do that. I didn't read one review by anyone, including my own review, that suggested that he was more capable or better of a candidate, or that he could even match the image that he's projecting in his TV ads. But attacking the other candidates, when it may very well be that one of those candidates is the nominee, and saying you can't defeat Donald Trump is a way of undercutting the Democratic Party, and only generates more problems for him, because that means that he is wide open to the argument that's already been used that, hey, Mike, you're not really even a Democrat anymore. You ran as a Republican. You supported and endorsed George W. Bush. You contributed to Republican House and U.S. Senate members, helping them get elected. Then you ran as an independent, and now you're declaring again that you're a Democrat, which was what you were before you were mayor. You know, who are you and why are you better than anyone? And it's not working for him right now.
I always ask the question, and I think it's timely after this debate, but who does the DNC want? We know they don't want Bernie. Bernie is an outsider. He does not represent the leadership of the DNC. Maybe it's Buttigieg. Maybe it's Warren. Maybe it was Bloomberg. But after the debate, by your estimation, who do you think the DNC would want to throw their support behind? Who do you think that they're most confident about?
All right, so Jared, that's a very good question. You know, let's not forget about Joe Biden, because at one point Joe Biden was the favorite, but you know, then the whole electability question and has come up because of what's been perceived as the poor performances and a kind of a dull image in the previous debates. With that said, though, I think we're at a stage where the DNC would prefer anybody but Bernie. And that's why they're looking closely. It could be any one of the other candidates. There's still talk behind closed doors that if Bloomberg fails on Super Tuesday, that Bernie goes to the convention either with enough delegates, and that's possible, to outright win the nomination, or that he's just short of the required delegates, and that there's a brokered convention and they find someone. Joe Klein, longtime writer for Time magazine, has been suggesting that at a brokered convention, a progressive liberal senator like Sherrod Brown, very popular in the state of Ohio, might be the figure that Democrats lean toward. However, that would just be a battle royal if something like that were to happen. Number one, he has not been out there. Number two, Bernie Sanders people would have a fit. And number three, it would be another older white man, which is not necessarily the demographic that a lot of non-whites and women would be looking for.
You know, I to get back to your point on Joe Biden, and you are absolutely correct that he was the all eyes on Joe Biden. What I seem to have witnessed over the past couple, maybe few months, was his downward spiral because, like you mentioned, poor performances at the debates, and if not poor performances, not stellar performances in other debates, but journalists would ask him, about the Hunter Biden affair with Burisma, and you really saw it. And understandably so, Joe Biden snapping. But, that whole baggage that is a dark cloud on his campaign, to me, signals that I don't see how Joe Biden carries on. Now, you mentioned about a brokered convention, and this is going to, sound a little bit outrageous, but hear me out. Okay, what is the possibility that in the scenario you laid out where Bernie has the most delegates going into the convention, that anyone but Bernie could possibly be Hillary Clinton? Now, why do I say that? Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016. I think not only her supporters remember that, but I would imagine those at the leadership in the DNC share those feelings that it was robbed from Hillary by the Russians, and Hillary should be the president. And is it completely out of the realm of possibility? Is it too late? Is Hillary, too much out of the game? I can't imagine that somebody who spent their entire adult life wanting to be president and then came so close to having it is just ready to step away and accept it, especially when a few weeks ago or a month ago she came out with a documentary clearly trying to derail Bernie Sanders.
Okay, you can't really say never say never, because never got elected in 2016. So we've already jumped over that bar. But this is about as close to never a Hillary Clinton candidacy emerging from a brokered convention as I think you can get. I think there that she would get zero support from Bernie's people, or most of Bernie's people, who are driven by more than just anybody but Trump. I think they're driven by a belief in Bernie and Bernie's perceived authenticity. I think Bernie would have a very difficult time delivering many of his supporters to anybody else, meaning that they may or probably, would not even vote. The other problem with Hillary is that all throughout the campaign in 2016, 36% of all voters said that they trust her to tell the truth. Those numbers never changed. And here we are just about 4 years later, and those numbers still haven't changed. And so not that many more people believe Donald Trump can be relied on to tell the truth, but the fact is that that is something that's very damaging if you're trying to defeat Donald Trump. The fact that the putative candidate to fill in that gap, Hillary Clinton, is still not trusted by an overwhelming majority. So I guess I don't see it.
What about Klobuchar and Buttigieg? They had their moments during the debate. They, of course, scuffled with each other. How do you see following the debate where they stand in the race based on their last performance?
Well, you know, there's a brand new poll out. This is Friday, the 21st. Brand new poll out in Nevada that shows Buttigieg in second place. Now, it's Bernie at 31, Buttigieg at 17, and Biden at 16. Klobuchar still at 10.
That's Emerson, by the way?
Emerson, that's right. It's by Emerson and a TV station out there in Nevada. So Buttigieg is maintaining some good numbers. Now, will they show up for him in the caucus? That's one thing. Also, remember that perhaps as many as 70,000 Nevadans have already voted and voted before that debate. But I think to answer your question directly, Buttigieg may do well in Nevada, but I don't know where he goes from there. Remember, in the very next week in South Carolina, 60% plus of those who show up for the Democratic primary are African American, and Buttigieg really is at about zero, literally at about zero in the polls among African Americans. Klobuchar, who had been soaring and doing well, I think you have to say was hurt during the debate performance. I do not expect her to repeat in Nevada what she did in New Hampshire, simply because she was patching together an organization that she didn't have before New Hampshire in the state of Nevada. She raised some money to put together a quick organization, but she and Buttigieg are still going after the same voters, and her performance was a bad performance. Buttigieg got under her skin. She spent too much time in a rat-a-tat with Buttigieg, and she just did not come off as an admirable character.
Now, looking at Trump's base, he seems to be in the best position he's ever been with his base. His numbers are good. Gallup is reporting a 49% approval. I believe this is the highest he's had in his presidency. Mm-hmm. He has the unity of the party. His message is strong and powerful. You go to the Democratic side, and by far the most powerful message that appears could contend with Trump's message is Sanders, a political revolution. Mm-hmm. We need to, what did he said in the debate last night? We have rugged individualism for the poor and for the working class, but we have socialism for the rich. He wants to reverse that. I mean, it's such a powerful message. It's so easy for his base to connect with. It's a powerful message that could even gather the independents. But if it's not Bernie, what is the message that's going to unite the Democrats? Obviously, if it's not Bernie, it wouldn't be as progressive or even democratic socialist, the message that is. But what would Buttigieg, what would Warren, what would Biden, how would they go up against Trump?
Well, That's the problem. This is a 50-50 battle within the Democratic Party for the heart and soul and the message of the party. This is not new. It's a 50-year-old battle, but this is the most intense that battle's ever been. In fact, if you look quickly at the Iowa results and the New Hampshire results, you see that about 53% who have voted have been more moderate, and 47% who have voted have supported Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And so right there at the get-go, this has not been resolved. So your question is, you know, if it's a Buttigieg or a Biden, all right, they've got different messages, but will they be able to attract younger voters who are on the fence? That's an issue. Biden is trying to bring up the glory days of Obama, how close he was to Obama. That could be an ace in the hole because substantial number of voters who Democrats need to turn out are African-American and Latino and progressive and liberal. And the Obama connection is always a powerful one. But it's Biden who's delivering it, not Obama. If it's somebody like a Pete Buttigieg, then the message becomes youthful, thoughtful, unifying, different, a small city Midwesterner who lives in a, you know, in a plain wood frame home, and one of competence. And that is something that could be very appealing, but, you know, running as a manager or a competent, thoughtful person, in contrast to, you know, perhaps the exact opposite, you know, may not be an inspirational message at all. That's why we have to get through some of the clutter. We have to lose a few more candidates before we really get the kind of head-to-head debate between a couple of progressives and a couple of moderates, or one progressive and a couple of moderates, so that we see where there could be a connecting point. One possibility is income inequality that appeals to the middle class and to many non-whites and progressives. Not sure that that's enough.
Going back to Trump's base, now there's been speculation that he is making inroads into the African-American community and into the Hispanic community, and maybe even independents. Now, I'm always looking for the evidence that he has, high numbers or higher numbers of African-American and Hispanic vote when comparing previous Republican candidates and presidents. But I can only speculate. I know that, you know, a year ago, he reached out to Kanye. Kanye came to the White House. That was, you know, quite an event to watch. He's been doing this with other figures in the African American community. Is there any evidence to point to that he has expanded his base in those critical demographic groups?
Well, there's the beginnings of it. Remember the African American samples, you know, of 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 voters nationwide. Are smaller and have a margin of error. But what we do know is that last time around, he got 8% of the African-American vote. Polls are showing him right now 12, 13, 14% of the African-American vote, plus a pretty substantial number, double digits, among African-Americans who are undecided, which means those are folks that may not vote at all. If you look at it that way and think in terms of 90%+ of African Americans normally vote Democrat, well, if last time Hillary Clinton got 89% of the African American vote, that means that she lost that normal percentage of African Americans. It was a smaller African American turnout than previously with Barack Obama. It does mean a small but significant gains, especially if you're looking at Detroit and Flint and Cedar Rapids in Michigan, if you're looking at Madison, Milwaukee in Wisconsin, where look, every black voter who votes Republican is taken off of that that Democratic list. Every African American who doesn't vote is taken off of that Democratic total. Yeah, I think he's made some small but not insignificant gains.
Well, I'm going to say that on the domestic front, that about does it. As with our analysis of this week, just to be responsible, because this often happens in the media where there's a big story and then it just disappears. Oh, you know, we've been talking about the coronavirus and its effect. I'll just run over, you know, the latest of what I've been able to gather in my following. And then, Dad, of course, you chime in. But as of now, in terms of infected, I believe the latest is above 70,000. In terms of death, we've surpassed the 2,000 mark. You're seeing the beginnings of perhaps an explosion of cases in South Korea. That makes sense, given that it's just across the bay. By the way, I do want to point out that from an epidemiologist report, I'm seeing that in 80% of cases that people get the coronavirus, they're mild. The most extreme cases are for the other 20%. These tend to be people who are older, people with compromised immune systems, smokers, men, especially older men, and have already been suffering some illnesses. The economic impact is just starting to show its ugly head, or rear its ugly head. But I have to point out, even before that, before the coronavirus hit the news, if you looked at, and I don't remember the exact shipping index, but it had already fallen 9% in the first month of January, which was the lowest it had been since 2009 at the height of the financial crisis. So given that shipping is down at its largest percent since 2009, shows that the global economy was already kind of in a bad position. But the question is, what will the impact be of the coronavirus? We're already seeing that factories have closed. A significant number of people aren't going to work. I just saw a figure this morning that car sales are down 92%. So as this continues to build, if it continues to build, we can expect perhaps a shock on the global supply chain. I just want to say one other thing, and this comes from my days in teaching global history, when we would specifically look at China. For those who aren't familiar with Chinese history, you have to know the concept of the mandate of heaven. This is something that is ingrained within the Chinese psyche going back 6,000 years. It basically goes like this. A dynasty would come to power, consolidate the power, and then that was a signal to the people that this dynasty had its mandate to rule from heaven. And then over generations, maybe it was 100, 200, 300 years, eventually problems would arise, and it could be floods, it could be famine, it could be disease outbreaks, it could be excessive war. That then signaled to the people that the dynasty was losing the mandate. And so because this is a 6,000-year history ingrained into the Chinese psyche, no doubt about it, that concept of the mandate is still with the people. And I would argue that if the economic situation in China continues to worsen, the public is likely to either respond in maybe it's rebellion, maybe it's just more criticisms of the government, but they could be in a position, and I'm talking about the Communist Party, where this the signals could surface to the public that they're losing the mandate.
Okay, there's a lot there and a lot of good stuff there. So number one, China thus far has been immune to a large degree from the youthful protests that we see worldwide. We've seen some evidence, but because of its autocratic and tyrannical system, you know, it's been able to cover it up from the news and quell it. But something like this is the sort of thing, the virus that is, that could create a nationwide pandemic or urban center pandemic. Number two, in terms of just from an epidemiological standpoint, the growth rate of this virus appears to be slowing down. It hasn't reached a plateau, slowing down, but as you point out, it is over 70,000 infected cases and more to come. Thirdly, the economic indicators that you've reported, you know, I've seen as well, and I'm noting here in the United States that the Treasury yields are at a 30-year low, and that the price of gold, which is, you know, that backup reserve for people who, you know, lack confidence in the markets, is soaring. It's almost at, as we talk right now, $1,650 an ounce. That's $100 an ounce more than it was just last week at this time. So we're right, I think, to be paying attention to this. Even if the growth slows down, the economic impact can be far, far greater.
Well, that about does it for this week's edition of the 7th Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. And we'll be back next week, and we'll have a lot more to talk about.
We sure will. Have a good week.